This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumablet.
And our topic this week is...
The case for point-and-shoot cameras in 2024.
Awesome. But first, we have some follow-up.
Yes, we do. And it is something quite funny. I think I'll just pull the curtain on how we do the podcast sometimes. Is Yannick and I share a lot of links regarding on things we want to talk on the show or just on follow-up items. And a few weeks ago, Yannick sent me this more or less saying, hey, we need to talk about it on the show. And we both forgot to discuss it in the previous episode's follow-up section. So, funnily enough, today, he sent me a note saying, hey, don't forget to talk about this. I was like, hey, it wasn't my show note so that you don't forget to talk about this. So, in the end, I'll be the one talking about Threads and the fact they've entered the Fediverse. So this news is a bit, I think it's about 2 weeks old. It was more or less released a day or two before we started recording the previous episode.
It's a rare time where Threads news comes out before we do the show instead of during the show.
During the show or just barely after.
Yeah.
You're correct. But I guess we could have been a bit more time sensitive, but we forgot. But the gist of it is as follows. So I'll have a link in the show notes from the engineering blog. They call it Engineering at Meta. They have more or less the article as titled Threads has entered the Fediverse. A few things that are important. The experience is only available in a few countries. You have to be age 18 plus with a Plovic profile so you can enable Federation. Yes, as we previously discussed, this is an opt-in feature, which has its upsides and downsides, and I won't really reshare what we discussed in the past about this. Once you do that with your Threads.net account, you will be able, as a federated users, you'll be able to see, like, reply to, and repost posts from the Fediverse, and they're more or less teasing what we've discussed when we were talking about the somewhat unofficial public roadmap of their ActivityPub support, but they're saying that, oh, we're continuing to integrate Threads with the Fediverse, and then we have more things to come to make it fully interoperable with ActivityPub compliant servers. It seems that remembering the timeline, we kind of got a lot in this update. It's not just like likes and posts and things like that. It seems that we got a few of the weird in-between step that were targeted for the first part of 2024 in this update.
Did we? I feel like we only got one way federation, right?
Yeah, but one way federation was never part of early 2024, if you remember. Remember, it was supposed to be like likes and then comments and then, or it was posts and then likes. I forgot to take note of the exact order we previously discussed from the roadmap.
Well, I mean, right now, if you reply to a post that was posted on Threads from a Mastodon instance, that reply is sent, but it will never be shown to the user on Threads.
Interesting, meaning that other people in the Fediverse will see the reply, but not people on Thread.
Yeah, you are broadcasting, as a Threads user, you are broadcasting to the Fediverse, but none of that, nothing in the reverse sense is actually going to show up in the Threads app.
Right. Interesting.
And I don't think people who are turning this on are realizing that this is the case, which is kind of weird. Like, I've heard a number of people on podcasts this week say, oh, I'm probably just going to turn off my Mastodon account and go completely on Threads, which, like, to me, this is completely insane, just because, like, I don't understand why you would choose to use Threads instead of Mastodon. Well, if you like the algorithm, I guess, but, like, that does not work for me. But people who are doing that and also potentially shutting off all input from the Fediverse outside of Threads is kind of cringe, honestly.
Yeah, I think it goes back to this both-way communication that you've mentioned a few moments ago. And I think people are misunderstanding that that part isn't on yet, or like more or less coded. They also discussed a few types of content that are or aren't federated. They talk about posts with restricted replies, or replies to non-federated posts, or posts with polls, which seems to imply, they say, until future updates. And repost on non-federated posts. Funnily enough, there's a section about quote posts.
Which is a big topic. I don't need that discourse.
And they more or less end up the blog post talking about their phased approach to the Fediverse. So they do expect in the future, and I quote them, "We expect content to flow from the Fediverse into threads. Federated threads user will be able to see and engage with replies from their posts coming from other servers, or follow people on other Fediverse servers and engage with their content directly in threads. Our plan is for Fediverse enabled threads profile to ultimately have one consolidated number of followers that combine users that follow them from threads and users from other servers." And yeah, that's what I forgot, and that was the other key element. They were talking about like likes on your post and follow count. That was one of the first few things.
Yeah, that was so weird.
They were trying to consolidate those first and then say, "Oh yeah, we'll show you the post and the replies." Like, can you just start with the post and the replies?
Yeah, who cares about the fucking follower count?
Hey, in an approach where you kind of want to become the Facebook equivalent or the Facebook portal to the Fediverse, I understand why they want to get there. But again, you have to be fully aware that to consume the whole content of the Fediverse, you have to be on an ActivityPub compliant server today, not on threads.
I also just mean that like follower accounts are more of a suggestion on the Fediverse than they are a fact, because I have seen hacked users with hacked instances that just have a follower account of like int max basically, because the only instance they can do whatever they want with the data, so they could return false values, which is really funny. You also have things like different instances have different views of who people's followers are, and the only way to get the true list of followers is to go to the original instance and not access via the API of your instance, which complexifies a lot of stuff. So basically, like, Threads is wasting a bunch of time on a feature that the rest of the Fediverse clearly does not give a shit about.
Overall, I do believe it's good news. I'm eager to see. Again, did I bet any money? Not with you.
I don't think so.
Generally speaking, with the universe, I think it was somewhat rooting for Facebook to kind of like say what they were going to do. Excuse me, I kind of mixed the order here. But
no, you were right before. You just confused it again.
Oh, really? So yes. Say what they're
going
to do.
To do what they're going to say.
Thank you. See, it's not even a few minutes in the show. I always fuck up something in the order, but that's fine. So what I was trying to say is I'm glad to see Facebook has made plans, and right now they're committing to them by shipping in phases. And this is what more or less they've been saying that will be their big phase one. So they shipped it. I didn't personally enable it, just mainly because I kind of forgot to do it and not really too much. And I think it goes with my kind of Threads usage. I kind of use it, but I kind of don't. Again, because of photo stuff, I'm still a lot on Instagram, and I would see what people I follow on Instagram post on Threads, because like Instagram and Threads are kind of like somewhat somewhere related. Same thing with Facebook. You would see rarely on Facebook, but more on Instagram, like Threads content. And they were like, "Oh, go see what this person has said." Or they will literally post, show you a post of somebody you follow that says, "Hey, here's what they said on Threads."
I think their FAQ is really funny with regards to that, because there's an FAQ about Fediverse integration, which is like, okay, so this feature is about sharing with other social networks, right? And the answer is like, yeah. Okay, but what if I don't want to share with Facebook and Instagram? And then the answer is like, fuck. Those aren't Fediverse. Fuck.
Yeah, those have a green pass. They always share. You're forced, sadly. But yeah, so I kind of plan to do it, but I don't know. Like, I think it's a bit dumb for adoption, and I think that was one of your big arguments when we last discussed this topic, Yannick, is that you mentioned that by making it opt-in, it will then be easy to say, hey, see, 1% of our billion users on Threads have it enabled. Who cares? But just for that, I kind of want to go enable it, but I'm not a big Threads consumer or creator too much these days. So I'll still continue to say, hey, Facebook has committed to be fully ActivityPub compliant with Threads, and I will gladly promote that once they are. But for now, it seems that they've made the first step, and hopefully it's not there where they'll stop, because right now it is really a one-way focus where people in Threads push to the Fediverse with nobody else reaping the benefit of that. So yeah.
I do want to point out that one big user did join Threads and Federate to via ActivityPub in the last 2 weeks, which is the President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Oh,
so
really?
If you follow POTUS at threads.net, you can follow the President of the United States, which is a big deal for the Fediverse. Of course, all of the people like me who are stranded on Fedipact instances who have signed the pact to not let Facebook into the Fediverse, well, too bad. You can't follow the President of the United States. But yeah, that was part of the news that came out in the last week. And I saw a lot of people in the Fediverse who were very sad that they used Threads instead of US.gov or something to host a Mastodon instance. And it's like, can you imagine if the White House hosted their own Mastodon instance, how fucking hardened you would have to make that code base? I'm just saying, I'm not surprised. So that was in the news. And also, Fediverse users were a little bit bitter that Facebook designed a different logo for the Fediverse than the community designed one that everyone else was using. I personally think that the Facebook one is kind of nicer than the actual community one, but I understand their objections. It actually served to sort of create like a corporate logo for the Fediverse and then a community one, kind of like what happened with share buttons when Google decided the share button that everyone else is using sucks, so we're going to design our own that everyone is going to be confused by for the next 5 years back in the day on Android.
Good. So we'll jump into the main topic. And this week, I want to discuss for the case of point-and-shoot cameras in 2024.
Hell yeah.
This topic came to mind with the mix of a few arguments and ideas around day-to-day photography in the life of photo nerds, of normal people, and what I've been hearing from friends and colleagues. And it is kind of my, I'll call it a plea to say that I think this type of cameras should come back more in the years to come. And I think they've already started. And we'll talk about some exact models that you've heard in the past in this show. But I decided to split this episode into three whys. Because yes, we're also programming nerds in corporate jobs. We have to run some root cause analysis using the why methods. Or I think it was the five whys, but I didn't need three for the sake of my argumentation for this episode.
I'm so glad I don't have to do that in my job.
You don't have to do root cause analysis for incident and prod? Oh, interesting.
Nope.
Interesting. Getting aside though and not talking too much about my corporate job, we will be talking about the first one, and I would like to discuss why were they dead? Because point-and-shoot cameras, as their name suggests, is a pretty simple-to-use type of camera. As the name suggests, you point and then you shoot and then you end up with cameras. And those model of cameras existed like way back in the day. I think that's more or less when even film photography became mainstream is when they got invented, depending on which film technology. But today, I am putting all aside on film. I know I've been big in film in the past 2-3 years, but it's not the goal of this episode, because I really want to focus about the digital cameras, and especially in the recent 15 years, why they were everywhere and they were pretty cheap everywhere, and then they got killed. Because if you wanted to buy a $200 or $300 point and shoot cameras, or like you trying to buy a $200 or $300 MP3 players, you cannot do that, because you can guess it. Yes, they were killed by the smartphone, and especially a more recent version of the past 15 years with the iPhone and all the Android phones gaining better and better photography equipment attached to them.
I would even say it was as early as the iPhone 4, right? Because I think like the iPhone 4 was the first iPhone that I can remember that had a ridiculously good camera for what it was. And yes, it was originally what prompted me to actually buy my Sony NEX3 that I just recently replaced. It got me excited about photography when I had not been excited about photography in a long time.
Right. Before we talk about the iPhone and the smartphone and why it got killed, I would like to discuss for sure that their introduction, and I would even say their golden era of the introduction of digital photography. Because I like that you mentioned your NEX5 again, because I think one of the reasons they were really popular in the early 2000s is when the technology behind digital cameras got, I would like to say, small enough. I would say it's well-oiled enough, meaning that we cut the rough edges, we knew how to develop it accordingly, and for sure shrink it considerably. It meant that the small sensor sizes were easily produced. They proliferated quite heavily, and I think that's where we saw them shrink in size and also have shrinking prices too.
I think there's also like a counterbalance to that, which is it's not just the miniaturization of the camera hardware, but also the proliferation and ease of sharing. Because if you remember, like camera flip phones, there were Moblogs. I haven't said that word in so many years, which used
Moblogs?
To be
Moblogs.
You don't remember Moblogs?
I don't remember.
Okay, Moblogs were photo blogs that you could post to from your smartphone by emailing the MMSing the image to a certain code, and then you would have like a hosted account on a website that would automatically post that to your Moblog. And
wow, I those were per- about this.
Yeah, those were pretty popular with like Sidekick people and like you know, that kind of like hip technology person with a pre-iPhone smartphone. That was where I saw most of my mobile photography beforehand, was on Moblogs and Flickr, because Flickr sort of had the same functionality built into it.
Right. And at that point, those small those cell phone and smartphone that you described, like the Sidekick, those were pretty bad. Like they were like the early 90s, like webcam sensor size inside of them, compared to what you would get in a point and shoot. So if you wanted half decent images, you were still quote unquote stuck with them. Related to the miniaturization and the shrinking in prices, I think one of their aspect that caused their demise was also their shrinking prices, because there was a race to the bottom. If you can remember, I remember my first digital camera that I purchased myself was one of those cheap, I think it's early 2000, so it was pre-bankrupt Kodak, but it was still like $100 like digital camera Kodak that was, I think, 2 or 3 megapixel, but that was the cheapest thing ever. But it was sold as kind of like, oh my god, like it's your first digital camera. And it was crazy, and it's still crazy to me that those were literally a race to the bottom, because it meant that there was a lot of different models that were not different models, aka they were internally the same technical aspect, but just in different casing from different brands, which meant that they flooded the market with more or less meh product. They were just like, most of them were just bad. It was hard to figure out the good ones out of the sea of devices, which meant that when smartphone technology increased and improved, and it became even more feasible because of many iterations to have similar sensor size inside phones, which now we're getting into 2008, 2009, 2010, which brings us back to your comment about the iPhone 4. It was for sure common idea to more or less merge them. There was already the service that I forgot, but those make sense. Like, if you were already texting images from your phone to a special service to upload them, what happens when you already have a smartphone that has internet, that you don't have to go through a stupid MMS or even the web browser? You can just do that on the quote-unquote real internet. And at that point, that's where, for sure, technology caught on, and that's where we entered the, sadly, death of the point and shoot, but the golden age of smartphone photography. At that point, that's more or less where you would see like the early, like 20, you would see in the early 2010s, you would see a lot of development in those, even in more kind of I don't say professional, but more advanced point-and-shoot camera bodies. And you'll see those styles. We'll talk a little bit more later down in the episode. But the ones that might have not a zoom lens, they might have a faster lens, but it's a fixed prime lens. They might have more. They might have automatic modes, but they have advanced feature like exposure compensation, or they might have an aperture priority mode, or even have a fully manual mode with different shutter speeds, different aperture. It's not just a few fixed steps on the aperture, a few fixed speeds on the shutter. Kind of bridging the gap between an interchangeable lens camera with a point and shoot, but keeping the size benefits and the ease of use benefits. While the market was trying to figure that out, it seems that they didn't figure that out fast enough at the same speed of the cell phone market. Because if you were around and being a cell phone nerd at that time, if we'd start with the iPhone 4, to take back Yannick's example, which was 2010. Yeah, okay. I was off by one because iPhone 1, the OG iPhone is kind of iPhone 0. I was getting confused. So 2010, I would agree with you, Yannick, that this was the biggest bump from like the iPhone OG and even the iPhone 3G, which had abysmal phone cameras. The 3G got somewhat better, but then when the 4 launched, I think it was an 8 megapixel sensor. Like, it was not the typical 12 that we got for years, but it was close to that range. But it is at that time that it meant that it could be considered a serious market now, meaning that there was technical abilities and also benefits to users that while it is in your pocket, it is stuck on the back of a glass phone, there are still a lot of benefits for you to leave your camera at home and just use your phone. And for sure, that was the main driver in the next 10 years from, not even at that point, I would say from 2010 to 2016, I think it was already dead. Like nobody, if they add point and shoot, replace them, or if you were considering to buy one because you've been a photo enthusiast using your phone, you're like, nah, like my phone is always good enough. And either that, if I buy something now today, like in 18 months to 2 years or 3 years, I'll replace my phone and get even something better. So the rapid pace of evolution and already the ingrained upgrade cycles around phones meant that people didn't see the value of having a dedicated device with them just for taking photos.
I think I would push back on that a little bit, though.
Okay.
Because I think the iPhone 4 to iPhone 6-ish range of time is kind of where vlogging got really big and dedicated vlogging sort of point-and-shoot niche market developed. And like we don't think about it much now, but the RX100 is kind of like this mythical vlogging camera from the early RX100s are known in vlogging circles as like a really popular camera from that time. Yes. That was sort of an accidental vlogging success because it was actually supposed to be a really good still camera and nobody bought it for that. So I think like there was that. There's always the weird Ricoh geeks in the background. I don't want to go too much into that because I know that'll come up later.
Yeah, you're already mentioning two cameras I wanted. We will mention down the road, but yes.
But I mean, like those cameras were still around, and I think there was still a niche that was reaching out to them. And I think, to a certain degree, not all enthusiasts dumped point and shoots. I think it's just the casual consumer that dumped them.
Right, and I think you're totally correct. Is that the masses, more or less in those early 2000 years, they flock to the cheapest model they can get, and the race to bottom impacted them the most. Even at that time, we did add premium point and shoots. You've mentioned, let's take for example the Ricoh GR. At that point, it was called the GRD for digital. And they had a lineup in the 2000s of multiple GR Mark 1, 2, and if I recall correctly, it was the 3, or I remember the GRX. If you don't know what this one is, go Google it. There was an interesting concept by Ricoh. Spoiler alert, it's an interchangeable lens and sensor camera. I'll leave it there. But there was advanced point and shoot cameras still built and that had their following. We'll talk about the Fuji X100, but that was launched in 2010 with the introduction of the X platform. So there are cameras, and you're kind of going to part of my later argument with what you just said. Of those type of cameras, or maybe why I think point and shoot should be back, not the cheap one, but I'll end there for now.
There's also like a mid segment that I think we might be leaving out because like obviously it's going to be on my mind because I own two of them. The Canon Ixus line of cameras, which are not what you would call like an enthusiast grade point and shoot. It's a premium consumer point and shoot, which is very strange. It almost completely revolves around the usage of the automatic modes. It's a very good camera that is made to operate in automatic modes, and that's why I love it. If we don't talk about it naturally later, I will bring it up before the end of the episode because I have to talk about this camera someday.
It's interesting that you bring the fact that those are good as premium point and shoot, but designed to be shot in automatic mode. Because if we were to end the section about why I consider them dead, it's because more or less the race to the bottom and that most of the normal market were buyers of them, and now they're just buying phones. It's important to see why I think they're back now in people's mind. And the correlation I make with what you said about the Ixus being great to shoot with automatic is, I think, also why people are kind of getting not bored, but kind of feeling that phone photos are everything, are the norm. They are everything what you see. On top of that, I'll talk about the iPhone especially, but I think this applies to a lot of the high-end Android models. Samsung has known to be done this because they more or less try to copy what the Apple iPhone does.
Well, I don't know. The newest iPhones, I would say they copied more Samsung's homework than anything else. But
I would like to hear your opinion about this, because this is also why I want to discuss about that point. Is we've seen in the recent years that on small sensors, to get a lot of color science, a lot of crispness out of their small lens and small sensors, you have to do a lot of post-processing on them. Mm-hmm. But we all know that nobody loves to do post-processing. And yes, I hear you through my headphones in my head. Like, yes, you the nerd that loves to do post-processing. I'm not talking to you. I'm talking, generally speaking, people don't want to spend 3 hours in front of their phone, in front of their iPad, in front of their computer doing post-processing. But that is what the magic of our small computers is. They're small in form factor, but they're not small in power. They can do a lot of that post-processing for you automatically, which brings this quote-unquote beauty effect we've been seeing a lot on phone cameras. I think my first foray into this was when the XS got introduced. I think the iPhone XS was known for like going a bit too far with its processing pipeline, which meant that what I describe as a beauty effect is like if you take somebody's portrait and you soften their skin's pores. It's like you apply makeup to their face. But that's not what happened. It's just the post-processing that does that for you, more or less thinking that this is something you want.
And to be fair, this is something that is incredibly common across Asia in general. Like, when I take selfies with my friends in Japan, 99% of the time they will have that filter, like an explicit filter app on their phone to take the photo, and I will look absolutely stupid at the end of it. And I hate it every time.
Right, and I think, I don't want to say it's because of that, but I think because the trends are going there, smartphone camera manufacturers are trending toward that. And the crazy part to me is, like I mentioned, I make a specific model of iPhone that was known to do that. At that time, I never owned a XS myself, but at that time I had an iPhone X, and then I got an iPhone 11 Pro right after it. And either before or after, of course, the model before didn't really add too much processing, but even the model after, which was conceived in a world where that was present, it was known to be less problematic because whether it was tuned down. But even then, there was no software update to apply that to the XS. And we've seen that. And I forgot if this was the 12 or the 13, but I know also one of the iPhone in between the one I got with the 14 after kind of pushed the bar a little bit again, closer to the extreme that the XS was. So it seems that depending of the general trends, and again, today, because I know most iPhones, I will be talking a lot about iPhones. But from my understanding of what I see with my friends and colleagues and photographer friends that also have insert name of Android phone here, they do fit on that scale. They might be closer to the iPhone XS or closer to my 11 Pro, for example, which I felt that it was a great balance. You can find the same issues there too. And I think it's, generally speaking, because we're pushing the technical aspects of those lens and sensor too much. Like, we've seen with the smartphones, the cameras gets bigger, the bumps gets bigger, because photography is still has an important aspect to it. And I don't want to nerd out about physics because I suck at physics. Yannick can attest to that. we did both our physics course together and we both sucked at it. So, but the part I do generally understand is the bigger the lens, the more light gathering, and the bigger the sensor, the bigger light gathering effect it has.
I think there's also a really funny thing, which is like the bump is getting bigger, the lens is getting bigger, but I feel like the photos are getting worse.
I was getting there next, right? Because again, if the lenses are getting bigger, the sensor, from what we've been told, are also getting bigger. And if you listen to your photo nerd's friend, the bigger the sensor, the better light gathering, aka the better photo you should take, right? I'm not opening a APS-C versus full frame versus medium format debate for this week. But again, there's some physics behind this.
Yeah,
but it all sadly falls back to what happens after the light has been gathered.
What's the processing pipeline?
Exactly. And I think that's where I personally, there is a where, and I know you echo those sentiments too, because that's also part of what kicked me to kind of talk about this week, is we feel that the general consensus of when you upgrade your phone, you get a better camera is less and less true nowadays for the past, I would say, 3 years.
Yeah, I can understand how Apple can convince itself that it's selling a better camera, because I think there is a consumer out there that wants their photos to look the way that they do. But just to give context, I went to the Moving Gundam exhibit in Yokohama, which recently closed. It's a giant Gundam robot by the side of Tokyo Bay, and they have a nice light show and everything, and I was there. It was a rainy night, extremely rainy night actually, so there were lots of reflections and stuff, and I took photos with my I was gonna say my NEX, but actually my Alpha 6700 and my iPhone, and there are photos from the iPhone that I'm happy I took, but in the grand scheme of things, I would consider 85 to 90% of the photos I took with my iPhone during anything outdoors to be completely unusable by my standards. And I hate that. And I would say, like, the problem that I have is that it looks completely overprocessed and not natural. And generally, when I take photos, I like for photos to look either exactly how they look to me or how they felt to me. And the iPhone feels like neither. It's just like, here is an artist's rendition of what we think it felt like. And it misses so often that it drives me crazy. When I look at the Gundam photos, like, the lighting looks, first of all, it looks brighter than it looked to my own eye, which is weird. And everything just looks super crisp and detailed in a way that it was not. It almost looks like I was looking at a figure of a Gundam that I took a photo of that had all of the, like, well, I don't know how familiar you are with Gundam models, but Gundam models have what we call panel lining, which is they're like lines in the model that you're meant to draw in with marker to add like emphasis, so it looks more like a comic book. It looks like those bits of marker were done, and that I was like looking at a figure that had really good panel lining, but that's not what I was looking at. I was looking at like a really expensive, like every industrial company in Japan came together to work on this. It's like, and it just looks completely weird. And then I look at my Alpha shots and they're like, yeah, that's what I saw. And it feels like two completely different realities. And honestly, like using my iPhone during this trip, I was completely pissed about the iPhone the whole time, which is why I barely posted any pictures to Instagram, because I was taking photos that I wanted to share with Instagram on my phone and I hated them, so I didn't post them, and my family was pissed. So it's like,
but that's a different problem.
Yeah, that's a different problem. But it's like, I'm honestly regretting buying the iPhone 14 because the camera on my 10R was better. And I know, like, in physical terms, it probably wasn't better in terms of the lens and the sensor and all of that stuff. But the end result is I looked at the photos from the 10R and I liked them. And I hate most photos that I take with the 14.
Yeah. I am not down that far with the 14 Pro. But I have my own anecdote events like the one you just mentioned with the Gundam. about my lackluster experience with the 14 Pro. And I think I'll give you the example because, funnily enough, I have a film photo of the same shot that I'm not looking at it with my I love film eyes, but the way you just describe it reminded me of that moment. I was like, yeah, the film photo, you know what? Ignoring the fact even it was even with a fucking flash. It adds a flash. And it was better. So, I think it was 2 Christmas ago, or maybe 1, I forgot. So, yeah, I think it's 22. My family came over, and the next morning, we all in our PJs. So if you ask for the photos, no, it's not going on. We're all in the PJs. But I was like, oh, we forgot to take a family photos in front of the Christmas tree, blah, blah, blah. So I, on purpose, put a tripod in our living room. And Tony says, oh, I'll put my phone. So I think I took the photos first. Put my Ricoh R1S, film point and shoot. Use its timer feature, use flash, because, hey, we're inside film. You have to use flash. Shoot it. And then it's like, oh, people make fun of me because I'm still at post-processing. let's not go get back there. But let's have a phone photos. And I don't know why. For sure, like, my living area is full of windows, which means that you are always more or less backlit because that's why there's a lot of windows. There's a lot of sun coming in. So it's nice for living area, not so nice for backlit photos unless that's what you wanted. And the way the phone dealt with that was just weird. It softened the image so much that we kind of believed it was like taken while moving. Like, I think, how do you describe your own hand posture when you take photo? Like the shaky coffee person or something like that? You always make me laugh when you describe how you take photos, and that's why you use a burst mode.
Although to be fair, on the Alpha, I no longer use burst mode because the in-body stabilization is so good.
Oh, okay. I'm
living a new life.
yes. But the phone was on a tripod, like with the phone mount that was, and it was using the Apple Watch remote control, so there was no way for it to be shaken. And I have a few moments like these. I'm like, huh, this is lackluster of an image compared to what I'm used to it. I think the other moments where I say that is I feel that, especially when it's a sunny day, that the eye dynamic range, and I use the technical term here, not the technical term that described the HDR process we used to do in Photoshop and Lightroom like 10 years ago. But I bring this up because sometimes I see the photos, I'm like, was that HDR done on Lightroom 3 or something like that, or aperture? Because it kind of reminds me of this eye contrast. And sometimes it is that bad that you swipe from photos to photos in photos.app, and then you see a nice photo, and then poof, it loads the HDR data. I'm like, no. Give me the SDR photo. The SDR photo looks better.
Yeah.
I bring all of this is to say is what I start to hear. Like, Yannick and I talk a lot about this, our own feeling about that. But I start to see people mention this on the web too. And even like colleagues, friends, but just like, as you may have guessed from the past 2-3 years of this podcast, I do a lot of more photo stuff these days and spend more time on photo stuff online. And I think that's why point and shoots are coming back these days. It's because people see phone photos as being the norm. If you want to be different, you have to find a way to be different. And if all your friends have an iPhone 15, an iPhone 14 Pro, and a 14 Pro Max, and then the Google Pixel 8 and Pixel 8 Pro, and like they all shoot using the main camera that is in the range between 23 and 26 millimeters, like everybody's in the same box of ultra wide range with a lot of post-processing, like the second you want a different style of image, it's hard to get out of your phone. And I say that without downplaying the fact that it means that a lot more people can enjoy the joy of photography with what has become modern smartphone photography. But, and I think I say that with the utmost seriousness, but I think it was about 18 months ago, or I might be rough on my time. I remembered it was getting viral on photo blogs, but because it got viral on TikTok, but there were a lot of just popular people on TikTok saying like, oh my God, when you use a quote unquote real camera, see, look at what I was able to do. And it was, okay, the more pessimistic people in us will be like, of course, better camera, real camera, it's better. But it was glad to see people say like, yeah, I want to take self-portraits of me on a beach sunset. It is hard condition. If I use a flash to fill a bit my face and things like that, like, of course, you get a better picture because you control more light. And there was this type of example where they were showing phone pictures in struggling conditions. And then you saw, you didn't show which camera they were using, but it was clear from the way the photo was taken that, of course, there was a fill flash somehow. So whether it was from a flash on a body or an external flash or things like that, yeah, of course, that does help. But with people having the realization that having dedicated equipment that allows you to create differently, you can have different results. I think that's why we get to where we are today, where we'll talk about my beloved Fujifilm X100 series. As I mentioned in the previous episode, I have a X100S that I got from Yannick's dad. But if you search for this camera's name on the web, you know that now its previous mark, so the X100V4.5, was more or less out of stock since early 2022. In February, Fujifilm announced the Mark 6 or the VI. They decided to use Roman numeral now. Don't ask why, but it's Mark 6. And it's launch, and you start people seeing having them. But if you go to your favorite camera store today and want to get your name on the list, it will be months again. So people are freaking out. But I think not only for this camera, I'll name two other cameras. If you're a rich, cool kid, you already know about the Leica Q series or the Q3. The Leica Q2 was around for a long time, but last year in May, Leica launched the Q3, which was more or less critically acclaimed, even if it's pretty expensive, as with any Leica product. And even if it is long in the tooth, it is still considered by its following and, generally speaking, photo people, a good camera, the Ricoh GR and the GRX, depending of which focal length you want. Those are more or less these days, if you look for a great point-and-shoot camera, that's what you have on the market. So the market has shrunk a lot, and they all fit into the similar category that Yannick started to talk about. They are, for sure, prime lens. There are no zoom. Yes, they might have adapters and adapter lens that you can put on top of the lens to either get a wider angle or telephoto. I think the Leica Q3 with its high megapixel sensor does it by just doing a digital crop. The Fuji X106 does it with a digital crop too, or you can buy adapter lens to get down to 28 from 35. It's usually a 35mm camera. 35mm focal length in full frame equivalence. But you can get to 28 or 50 depending on which adapter you can buy. And I know the Ricoh GR has similar things. But the GR itself, the GR3 is 28 versus the GR3X, which is more or less the same camera, same sensor. It's just that they changed the fixed lens for a 40mm model. But they also have a lens adapter that you can buy. So as you can see, for those three cameras, different vocal. It's a fixed vocal length, as you can see, compared to typical, what the phones call "quote unquote" normal vocal length or the default vocal length, which is driving the biggest sensor, is usually in the range of 23 to 26 millimeters. So a tighter crop compared to those. And of course, all of those three cameras are having way bigger sensors. Each of them also have different points. I think those three are generally acclaimed because they are cameras with character. They all have different characters, but they are something that will fit different people. But I think they still go back to, they don't give you phone photos in the end. They give you photos that are different from the pack. And again, if you're an interchangeable lens camera person, you kind of like, hey, yeah, I can get the same style because I can put the proper focal length in front of my big sensor camera and do the similar post-processing. Yeah. But they also do that with the convenience of not having to deal with multiple lens, usually having simpler automatic modes than interchangeable lens cameras. I wouldn't say the Leica Q3 is. It's more or less kind of a non-interchangeable lens, interchangeable lens camera, if you understand what I mean for this. But that's the thinking. I think those three right now are driving their comeback, the comeback of the market. But if you compare it with what was available years ago, or even, and that's where Yannick, you'll be able to talk about the Canon XS's, they're not really simple point and shoots. Yes, you can put them in all automatic mode, but I think they are still the first step after a simple point and shoot that more or less has automatic mode. And yes, I say that about the phones nowadays too, downplaying all the amazing third-party apps or even some of the first-party apps, manual modes that you can have. But the jump between going from those apps to a dedicated camera are more or less the same thing. You have to understand the exposure triangles, so aperture, shutter speed, and ISO. So once you do that jump, usually having a dedicated camera makes a bit more sense to understand all of that. So this brings me to the fact that like the general like point and shoot that we used to know and love, it's still not coming back, but I think point and shoot can create their own valuable niche as the, I was about to say the first step, but maybe the only step a lot of people will do to say that, hey, I am a photo enthusiast. I do a lot of my content using an iPhone or a smartphone, but I have a dedicated camera and a dedicated camera like, we'll use the example, the Fuji X100 6, and that's what I do with the rest. Those are big, or like there's a lot of competition, but the price are high. So I think this brings us to the next why, and I think why aren't more manufacturers jumping there too? And it's kind of sad because I think right now we're in a stage where we can see that Fuji, for example, has a lot of success with what they've been launching for the past 2-3 years. Ricoh with an old product. I'm not saying it's a bad product. I really want to emphasize that point again, that when I say old, it's because it's true. It's a 2019 camera, but people still really love the output produced by the GR3. And again, that camera with its 24, 26 megapixel add in-body stabilization way before the Fuji X100 that just got it. So there, it has features, technical features that was like pioneered for small point-and-shoot cameras like when it got launched. So I don't think it downplays that. But even then, because of the popularity of the Fuji, people are like, oh, what's the next available, a great available option? Like, and then you go into Ricoh and then it's like, yeah, they're nearly sold out everywhere because of that too. And then when this is also sold out at your local store, like maybe you're the money no object type of person and you jump to a Leica Q3, or you then are not that type of person and just wait. So you could possibly reflect on like, hey, it would be nice if more there would be more competition in this market. And one thing that I think that will be nice to bring this is these cameras are making good progress to bridge the gap between the benefits of their own big optics and big sensor and the downside that they're not connected all the time. Like you want to minimize the moments you feel like, oh, I'm not sharing photos because it's hard for me to get the photos out of the camera. I wouldn't be surprised in the months to come when we talk about our own camera purchase that Yannick and I will discuss about the smartphone apps for more recent camera.
Unfortunately, and, yes.
Yeah. Because you don't want to end up with this with buying a new camera and not sharing anything out of it, because then if you don't, if you use it and just leave the camera, leave the photos on the SD card, then I'm not saying you should share it to the world, but at least make sure you enjoy your own photography, whether it is with wallpapers, whether it is printing, whether it is digital slideshows. Like you should enjoy your own photography, but you cannot do that if all the photos on the SD card in the camera and not somewhere else.
So I mean, last weekend I was showing everyone my Japan photos at the Easter supper at my grandma's house, so like we've done that. I think the main issue for me is not so much I don't know how to get the photos off my camera, but more so, oh shit, where do I put them, because everything sucks nowadays.
Yeah, I'm not going there, but I think this is something that I hope that by making a full-on art comeback, that the point-and-shoots will be the category of devices that will be the bridge between what is the majority market of photography with smartphone and in the more niche market with the mirrorless interchangeable lens cameras that you and I like.
I don't know that there's really a market case for I was going to say for enthusiast point and shoots, but then just go look at Fuji and how well they're doing. And it's like, well, okay, maybe I'm an idiot.
Yeah, that's the issue, is because if you look at the point and shoot, and I know you were trying to make this argument a bit earlier, it's like, yeah, but like, look at the point and shoot that survived. I was like, yes, Yannick, look at the point and shoot that survived from 2010 to now. The X100 series was successful, but I think since 2022, 2021, got way more successful than it was before. Like even today I was reading news, they're like Fuji is not able to figure out how they'll fulfill all the orders to this day. They're like,
it's just, it doesn't make sense to me. I guess like people are gonna buy what they're gonna buy, but like if I'm going to spend big bucks on a camera, I probably want a more flexible body like my Alpha, then I would want to go all in on a point and shoot. Like it doesn't make sense, especially like when you consider the mountains and mountains of used digital cameras that are out there that
right.
do a pretty damn good job still to this day. Like I was using a 2009 Digicam in Japan to take photos at night, and I took some really good photos, and I was like, wow, that is a shockingly good photo for a camera from 2009 that is better than the one I took on my phone. I like this. So I think like I don't understand if you can make a product that is good enough to sell at upmarket prices that is worth the downsides of not being a mirrorless interchangeable lens camera. But then again, like, yeah, okay, the Leica is expensive as fuck and people buy that because it's like, it's, well, it's jewelry also. Like, yes, I understand.
It's a
like the stereotype, but yeah, it's like the stereotype of Apple products that everyone goes to. It's like, it's super expensive and it's super stylish, except even more so because it's actually super expensive and not just like within reach expensive.
Right. Totally. I think you're making a good point. And I'm not sure I fully agree, but I get where you're going with this. And
I think I'm just a cheapskate. That's the problem.
No, I think that's why especially the interchangeable lens cameras market has been going up market. Like we've discussed privately in the past, like when you bought your NEX and I bought my still around Nikon D5000 DSLR, more or less 12 years ago, 13 years ago at this point, like you could buy more or less a good DSLR kit for $1,000 Canadian. And you could have a few lens, maybe one or two. They would still be kit lens, but still you could make something work under $1,000 or give or take on $1,000, $1,100. Nowadays, like, don't count it. Like, there's maybe two or three cameras below the $1,000 mark. And if you read all the reviews, like, they more or less have the same argument as you say. They're like, why buy this mirrorless camera that is pretty really limited in its functionality when for, sadly, $400 or $500 more, you would get something more that would give you more flexibility. So you see that they're going up market. And I think it is leaving a space, not that will not be served by Leica, don't get me wrong, where companies like Fuji, like Ricoh, like Sony, like I'm not ignoring them. Like I think Sony had the great history with the RX100, the RX1, which again that was a full frame point and shoot, so the price was not ideal for this one. But
the price was not the problem with RX1. To be clear, there were other issues with that camera, like manufacturing and stability issues with that camera that made it undesirable. But the price was not the issue with that camera.
True. But people still loved it too. They still loved the fact that it was a full frame point and shoot, more or less like the Leica Q3 or Q series.
People loved the idea of it. I don't think they liked the execution of it. I think if it had been a good product, they would have kept it. But everyone I know who bought an RX1 got rid of it very fast.
Fair, but I've seen people a lot following the popularity of the Fuji camera saying like Sony needs to get back in this game. They had good ideas and they've shown they had good ideas. I mean, they maybe not have shown that they have great execution on certain of those, like you just mentioned. But again, they've shown that they could do something there.
Sony kind of has a weird Microsoft problem when it comes to cameras because they're often like too early to something and they have the right idea. They just don't want to stick it out and actually figure out the execution and they just cancel it and move on to the next thing. And it's like, no, that was actually good. It's just you didn't do it right.
Right. And overall, my personal answer of why aren't there more manufacturers dropping there too is I think exactly what you said, Nick, sadly. I don't believe that's a good... I can understand the business decision behind it because, yes, you might want to sell a Sony A7 III Mark IV versus selling an RX1 that will get returned because it's poorly built. But these days, it seems that camera manufacturer to more or less survive, they've carved out their niche up market, pro market, and then camera nerds, knowing that the money is no object category or group of people is where they'll make the most money and make sure they can buy multiple cameras, but still leave this group. And I think that's where we see smaller camera manufacturer like filling the gap. But I kind of wish a bit there was more competition to see things evolve a bit more fast, because I think that, and that's where I was kind of bringing the argument of saying like, hey, I think one aspect of photography, and I'm not bringing back the post-processing, but like still there are important key elements of computational photography that is good on smartphone photos and smartphone cameras that could be brought to dedicated cameras that are sometime brought up or not brought up. And I think a good example, never used it, but I've seen reviews of it and it looks nice, but the OM system cameras have things like called Live MD, which they more or less like do computational photography to simulate long exposure like that if you had the ND filter. So for to do like long exposure waterfalls, for example, they can more or less do that. Or another feature that they have is, I forgot the name, but live bulb mode, if I recall correctly. But you more or less see your exposure built on your screen by just having this bulb mode open and see your long exposure built, and they're able to figure out that, okay, as the highlight part might get overblown, so we'll do the calculation to make sure that you end up with a well balanced image too. And if I recall correctly, you can draw, just do that on this portion of the screen. Just like take an image for like the dark sky, leave it dark, but where the cars pass, that's where you do the accumulation of light. So there are a few things, but again, I've mentioned OM Systems, which is one camera manufacturer. Most of the other people, they don't do it.
A pretty small one too, but I played around with their cameras at CP Plus because I went to the Camera Expo in Yokohama, and I played with cameras from basically every manufacturer that they had on the show floor. And those OM System cameras, man. Originally, when I was buying my first Sony, I was also very tempted by the Olympus thing and their new cameras. They gave me that same vibe. They were like, Olympus never died.
They do have, dare I say, a cult following. Like, people that use their cameras, from what I read in like online communities, like people that use their product like them. Even if they're not the most technologically advanced product, they have specific functionalities that the competition doesn't have. For other functionality, the typical like autofocus speeds on mirrorless cameras is always the most important things that reviewers talk about. Like, it's not the best, but still people see the benefit of the Micro Four Thirds system, and people that use it love it. And that's exactly where I'm getting back with the point and shoot. Is there was people that love point and shoots back in the day.
Yep.
Those people, I'm not saying it's exactly the same crowd, but I wouldn't be surprised that there are a new crowd and also people that kind of like reminiscent of point and shoots compared to what they experience with smartphone photography. And it is hard for them these days to feel fulfilled unless you're on a waiting list for a camera that is available but backordered. So that's why I wish there was a bit more competition, because I would be nice to see this part of the photo market evolve too.
Use all of that spare money you have lying around to wait on that waiting list and go buy yourself a little like $75 Canon camera and go shoot some photos with it. It'll be just as good.
Right. And that's it.
Yeah, I do want to actually talk a little bit about the My Digicam kind of story, because it kind of ties into this, right? So, like a year and a half, 2 years ago, I think, I just got interested in old Canon point and shoots. And I bought the IXIS 700, which was like a 2005 small form factor point and shoot camera. And I got that for like $50 on eBay. And it was a lot of fun to shoot with. I think I liked at that point, I still think I was on the 10R. At that moment, and I was shooting photos in the daylight with the IXIS 700, and I preferred those daytime photos to the iPhone photos. So already there was like something different about the photos I was taking with that camera that was nice, except unfortunately I mostly go out at night, and I mostly like taking photos of night stuff. And don't worry, like, that camera is capable at night. There was a photo I took of you at the port here in Trois-Rivières when I was pressing it down on a trash can. And that photo, it's insane how good it is for a 400 ISO photo in the middle of the night on this little point and shoot from 2005. Like, I love that photo. It's so fucking good. So, I mean, it's capable, but, you know, it's me, Mr. Coffee Hands. I'm not going to be able to take photos like that handheld. So I went out and I got a different model from 2009 that I saw someone was shooting really good handheld night shots in Japan with. And I think, I don't know the IXIS number, because IXIS is the European brand. It's IXI Digital in Japan, and it's the PowerShot SD series in North America. So I got an SD, I think it's 910IS, which has image stabilization, which kind of fixes the handheld issue for me. And that's actually what I brought with me as my iPhone replacement for Japan. So anytime I would have shot something with my phone that I actually wanted, like, that kind of, not field of view, but, like, I have a 30mm lens on APS-C on my Alpha. So anything that I wanted, like, a wider shot, I would use the XS4, or anything that I wanted to take as a more subtle photo, because my camera now, that, like, that's part of my complaints about the new Alpha, is it's just way bulkier and it stands out more than my old NEX did. So anytime I wanted to take something more subtle, I would get the PowerShot out. Like, I had a really, really great time shooting that, and I took some photos that maybe they weren't perfect out of camera, but they could easily be adjusted to fit the feeling. So there's a photo that I could probably put in the chapter art for this, if we do chapters, which I probably will now that I mentioned it.
I was not asking to, because, again, the only photos I mentioned I will not publish online, so...
Yeah.
But if you want to do them, sure.
I guess I just volunteered for it.
Yeah?
Yeah, there's a photo I took of a little bar down the street of where I was staying in Japan, and it was raining, and there's this giant green LED sign that just, like, lights up the night sky just by itself. And I took a photo of the reflection in the rainy night of this sign. And basically the only adjustment I had to do was to crank up the saturation, because I thought it wasn't green enough. But, like, like, I wanted it to look exactly as green as it did through, like, my rainy glasses, and you get the feeling. And so I just cranked the saturation to 100, and now I'm like, this looks perfect. It's not necessarily what the camera agrees is perfect, but it's what it felt like, and that's what's important for my photos. And I think, like, I just had a really, really good time with using digicams over my iPhone, that now I just carry one on me all the time. And I basically never use my iPhone for any photography whatsoever, unless it's something I need to share immediately. And it makes the iPhone sort of feel like a big waste of money, especially since, like, I was, okay, I'm going to get an iPhone 14 before my Japan trip so that I have a better camera. And I just ended up being so disappointed with my camera. I'm like, what the fuck do I do now? Do I ever update my iPhone? Do I just change the battery? I'm worried that it'll get worse, even worse. But yeah, like, it doesn't take a modern enthusiast level camera. It can literally just be like a $75 used camera you find off of eBay. And as long as it's the thing you're happy shooting photos with, like, I think that's great. And it doesn't necessarily have to be a point and shoot. Like, 90% of the time I use my big camera as a point and shoot, and nobody knows.
I'm glad that you brought up the small parenthesis about your Exus and Digicams, because one of the reasons I didn't want to discuss the Digicam market in this episode is because one thing I strongly believe at, and I know we'll talk about consumerism here for 3 seconds, but to have a used market, you need to have a new market. And it's funny, this argument comes a lot into, for example, cars, especially with sports car. People say, like, oh yeah, we wish we had more sports car, but, like, you need to have people to buy the new things to then have cheap used cars at some point. So that was one aspect why I was focusing more on why I think we should have more point and shoot built today, so that later down the road we can be reminiscent and enjoy those cameras for the years to come, like your excesses that you've been enjoying for the past few years.
Yeah, but I don't think the market segment for them really exists on the new market today either, like, even less so than the upmarket segment. So I don't know, it doesn't really make sense. And they sold so many of those
yes,
in the past, that there's a lot of e-waste just sitting around, might as well use it for something.
Oh, for sure, for sure.
Like, that's one of the things I hate about, well, retro gaming in particular as well, because I'm also very involved in that, is, like, you see people hoarding these extremely rare games and not playing them. And, like, I understand it's your, like, precious keepsake or whatever, but games are meant to be played, dude. And same thing, cameras are made to be shot with. Don't just keep it on eBay for an impossible price.
Agreed. And I say the same thing about cars. Cars are made to be driven, not to be parked in a car and being a garage queen.
Yeah, Jay Leno.
fair, but I think he used a wrong example here.
Probably.
As you know, those are being driven. I'm not a big... I'm pretty neutral about Jay Leno, so don't take any offenses
about what I say.
But yeah, I'm just saying, like, from what I hear, he drives his car a lot. Everything gets driven at some point, from what I gathered. Good. But that was it, and I hope you enjoy my case for point-and-shoot cameras in 2024. So, Mr. Coffians, let's get that flat.
All right. You can find the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/225, or you can find all of our previous episodes at limitlesspossibility.net. The show is on the Fediverse at limipo_podcast@mastodon.social. We are also individually on the Fediverse at our respective accounts. I don't know why I screwed up that ending there. I was trying to autopilot and it just kind of stopped abruptly.
Yeah, you screwed up your own account, by the way, just saying.
I didn't even start saying my account.
That's the point.
Okay, well, yeah, I am at Socarina at icosahedron.website and Luco Devier is at
Luco, that's L-U-C-C-O, at mastodon.social.
And I'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.